Well, I think it is my remit to give you some sort of flavour of the world of the genome at the moment. I mean, this is a world of sort of a pioneering world, a gold rush world, a world of fantasy and wild ideas. It's a great world to be involved in at the moment, but it is, of course, a world in which the output has to be constrained as it is implemented in society. At which point, I'm going to find it difficult to go without the slides.
Can you toggle your screen?
You want me to do that? Okay. As Martin has already indicated, the human genome is a long string of letters of code that amounts to about 3,000 million letters. And we have about 60% of it in this unfinished form at the moment. We're expecting 90% of it to be in this form by the end of the summer. And over the next couple of years, it'll be polished up and touched up and made into a much more acceptable product. But this is just a long string of letters. Within it, there is included an awful lot of information, but we have to extract that. And that extraction process, in the first instance, is going to be called annotation. And in that annotation, we have to ask a number of questions. We have to ask, how many genes are there? Now, you might have thought that given the progress of the genome sequencing as it is, that we might be able to come up with a reasonable answer to that question. But in fact, it is very controversial. There are some people who think there are about 50 to 70,000 genes. There are others who are suggesting there are 120 to 140,000 genes. So 100% difference between those two estimates. We will have the answer to that question, but it is slightly surprising we haven't had it until now. From the point of view of those of us who want to use this genome, there are a number of other questions. We have to find out where do each of these genes begin and end. Because as I'm sure you know, the proportion of the human genome that is actually involved in coding for the human machinery, for the proteins, is only about 3 to 5%. And the rest of it is what we can term junk. It's not really junk. There are some quite important bits in it, but as a shorthand, we can call it junk. For our purposes, however, we need to know where the junk stops, where do the genes start. And that's something which is actually quite a difficult thing to determine, and will take us 3 or 4 years to do so. Similarly, where are the sequences which determine, which regulate genes and their expression, which tell genes to turn on or to turn off? Then we'll have to look at all these genes and find out, do they fall into families or are there genes that are orphans, which have no similarities to any other genes, and what will those genes be doing? Do we have predicted functions for all the genes and the proteins that they encode? The answer to that question is almost certainly not. We may know of all the functions, possibly, and it may be that in time all those genes and their proteins will fall into the categories of functions that we know of already. However, there's the equally interesting possibility that there are functions or functionalities within cells that are coded for by genes that we can have no concept of at the moment. And we will have to start working with these genes, which have no obvious function, to try and work out what these new functionalities might be. As Martin has indicated, one of the first uses of the human genome sequence is to clear up that residue of absolutely classical genetic disorders that is still left with us. And this is an example that is troubling us in my lab. This is a genetic predisposition to a rare disease, and the affected are here in red. This exemplifies the problem. We've been able to map this particular disease to a region of the genome on human chromosome 17. But in that region, there are 300 genes. Now, in order to help this family, we need to work out which of those 300 genes is the one that is abnormal and that is causing this disease phenotype. However, for us to do that, or for us to do that 6 months ago, for example, we'd have had to work out the sequence of all those 300 genes ourselves, screen through them, looking for the abnormalities. In 6 months' time, all that sequence will be available to us. The task will not become completely trivial, but nevertheless, it will be simplified to a large extent. So that's classical genetic disorders. The next thing that is going to be very important to do with the human genome is to look for sequence variation. After all, we don't all look the same. And the reason we don't look or behave the same is because our genomes are not the same. Our genomes are different from each other. There are sequence variations. and about 1 in 1,000 letters of code is different between us. And this exemplifies, this shows some of these variations. I thought I'd show you a bit of sequence. This is what comes off the machines at the Sanger Center. This is what DNA sequence looks like. And this individual here, what you can see is that the 4 letters of code, A, G, T, C, in this particular, in the genetic alphabet, there are only 4 letters, and they are colored conventionally green, black, red, and blue. In this person here, as we walk along the sequence and read it, at this point, he just has a black, this person has a black G. But this other person, at exactly the same point, has got the peak for the G, but in addition, has got a peak for the A, in exactly the same place. And why should that be? It's because, of course, all of us has 2 copies of every genetic sequence, one coming from our father, one coming from our mother. And at some positions, these differ. So in this individual, his paternal sequence has got the G in this position, and his maternal sequence has got the A. These sequence variations will be very useful to us in examining a lot of aspects of the human phenotype. We can look at them to see whether which of them correlate with natural variation, height, weight, how fast we run 100 meters, how well we kick a football. We can take that further to look at slightly more troubling aspects of human behavior, such as intelligence, which almost certainly has a genetic component. And it will be possible to at least look for variants like this that might be associated with intelligence. But from our perspective, and from drawing on what Martin was talking about, these sorts of sequence variants will also allow us to look for those low penetrance, those low-risk predispositions to common diseases like diabetes and heart disease. And the way that this will be done will be like this. You can take 1,000 normal people, and you can look for how common this A peak is, and you may find it in 500 of them. You then take 1,000 people with heart disease, for example, and you look for how frequent this A peak is, and you may find it in 800 of them. So the fact that you're finding that A peak in 800 people with heart disease and only in 500 people who are normal would suggest that somehow this A peak is predisposing those individuals to develop heart disease. The next context in which the human genome sequence is going to be extremely influential is with respect to cancer. All cancers develop from a single cell. Our bodies are constituted of 100 million million cells, and cancers develop from a single cell that goes wrong. This is a piece of breast. Here on the left, you've got a relatively normal breast tissue, and on the right-hand side, this rather thunderous, threatening cloud of breast cancer. And you can see the way the breast cancer is behaving. You've got these tongues of cells which are infiltrating, invading, dividing, and destroying the normal tissue. And the reason why they're doing that, you can see at higher power here, you've got all these cells, which you'll have to take my word for it, are looking extremely abnormal, very wild. They're packed together, and despite the fact that they're packed together and they should stop dividing, they continue to divide as this one is doing here. Well, why should that single cell go on to expand into this large abnormal population? The reason is, from the moment that the sperm fertilizes the egg, and that egg goes on to develop into the adult being, all the cells that derive from that egg are being exposed to chemicals, to radiation, and to viruses. And those agents induce changes in the DNA sequence as life develops, each cell getting a different set of changes. So when that single cell acquires a sufficient number of changes in DNA sequence in the relevant genes, that cell then begins to behave in the abnormal way characteristic of a cancer, in which I showed you on the previous slide. So all cancers contain abnormalities of DNA, and they're being driven by those abnormalities of DNA. Those abnormalities are not usually transferred from parent to offspring. They're not present in normal cells of the body. They're only present in the cancer cells, but they're driving the cancer cells. So what we can do now with a normal human genome is we can use it as the basis of a comparison of the genome sequence in cancer cells against normal cells, going gene by gene in a systematic way, asking the question, is this gene different in the cancer cell compared to the normal cell? And where we find differences, that will suggest strongly to us that that gene, the abnormality in that gene, is driving that cancer to behave in this abnormal way. Is this an important thing to do? It has been a matter of, I suppose, strong belief in cancer geneticists over the last 20 years that these genes will be the critical targets for the modern therapies in the future. These are the weak points of the cancers, because if you can revert these genes or their proteins back to normality, then perhaps the cancer will also revert back to normality. So can we direct drugs against these genes specifically or against their proteins? Well, as I say, this was a matter of faith, but recently it's become more than a matter of faith. There is a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia in which there is an abnormality in a particular gene. 100% basically of chronic myelogenous leukemias have an abnormality in this one gene, and it's a very particular sort of abnormality. This was discovered in about 1985. And since then, there have been a number of efforts to derive a small molecule, a drug, that will interfere with a protein that is encoded by this abnormal gene in chronic myelogenous leukemia. And such a drug has recently emerged. And to our astonishment, in its phase one, so very, very early clinical trial, this was the outcome. 31 individuals with chronic myelogenous leukemia who were refractory to all other treatments, that's why they were in this phase one trial, 31 out of 31 went into remission with this drug directed at this gene. There hasn't been a clinical trial quite like this, and from the point of view of the ethics, the interesting thing is here, can we ever do a randomized control trial on this drug? Because who is going to want to be in the control arm? So this underpins the importance of finding the genes in cancer and certainly underscores our hope that it's going to make a big difference to cancer treatment in the future. I thought I'd diverge for a little moment to talk about the other genomes that are being sequenced at the moment. One of the most important ones is the mouse, and that will help us very much in analyzing the human genome sequence for a number of reasons, but the mouse is also the main experimental model in science for higher mammals. But I thought I would show you, because it sort of tickles one's imagination a little bit, this character here, this handsome guy and his kid. This is a Pan troglodytes schweinfurthii, or a chimp. Now, the reason I'm showing you this person is because his genome differs in about 1 in 100 base pairs from Homo sapiens. So 99% of his genome is the same as ours, more or less. Mankind is a pretty vain and narcissistic being, and Darwin shattered that mirror 150 years ago when he suggested that we actually derive from individuals like this. Well, we're going to have to revisit Darwin's legacy a little bit now, and we're going to have to look at where those differences between us and the apes are, and what that tells us about the genes that are different in their functioning between us and apes, and therefore, from that, why we do behave in rather different ways and have different attributes to the apes. So there is considerable interest and fascination in finding out about ourselves from sequencing genomes. And in addition to other higher animals, a large number of pathogens are being sequenced, and the sequencing of these organisms is going to contribute enormously to our understanding and to treatment of the disease. I've just selected here the latest output from the Sanger Center, Campylobacter jejuni. This is the organism which contributes most commonly to food poisoning in this country, and rarely to this disease of progressive paralysis known as Guillain-Barré syndrome. So this organism was recently sequenced, and the whole sequence went out onto the internet. And it exemplifies what happens when you sequence one of these organisms, because immediately, by looking at the sequence, the scientists involved were able to make very plausible hypotheses as to why this organism so commonly contributed to food poisoning and also contributed to this rare paralytic syndrome. So sequencing of genomes immediately gives you plausible hypotheses and further scientific springboards. And a large number of other pathogens are going to be sequenced. The organism for whooping cough, Mycobacterium tuberculosis was done a couple of years ago, the meningitis strains, and Staphylococcus aureus, this killer bug that is taking over our hospitals and is resistant to antibiotics. The resistance to antibiotics and the current tide of infectious disease that is appearing to overwhelm us is all encoded in the DNA sequence of these organisms, and knowing their DNA sequence is going to empower our fight to push those frontiers back. Looking at these little organisms can also give you some other insights, and this one I thought I would share with you. The sequence of Mycoplasma genitalis was interesting because this only has got 517 genes as opposed to about 100,000 in man. And in an interesting experiment, what one group did was they wanted to find out how many genes do you need for life? What constitutes a living organism? And to do that, they decided to knock out each of these 517 genes and then see whether the organism would survive. And each of these figures here represents a genome in which a gene, this red one here, has been knocked out, and this organism with this genome, it grew. So this gene was not necessary for life. And similarly for this one, this gene was not necessary for life. And similarly all the way down the screen, until the genes that were necessary for life turned out to be these ones here in green and that are arrowed. 300 genes are necessary for life, it appears. These are the basic constituents of the living organism. And what was particularly fascinating after whatever it is, 50 years of the study of metabolism and the bases of life, 100 of these 300 genes are of completely unknown function. We are starting again. So coming back to the human being, one of the major impacts of finding the human genome sequence is that it's going to take us to a much better understanding, as Martin has alluded, of the human machine. After all, the human genome sequence is not really the human blueprint. It's often said to be that, but it isn't really that. It's a catalogue of the basic specifications of the approximately 100,000 parts of the human machine, the 100,000 proteins, which are actually the moving parts. But it's really only a rather basic specification. It just gives us a feel for the materials that each of these moving parts is made of. And in future, what we're going to have to determine is what is the shape of each of these components, these springs, these coils, these beams, these struts. What do they do? And they're also going to have to ask which components are present in each sector of the machine. After all, the human body is composed of many different parts, and the same bits are not present in the brain as are in the liver, as are in the colon. And then we're going to have to go to a higher level of complexity. We're going to have to ask which of these components contact each other and how do they interact? How do they make this web of function of moving parts? And ultimately, can we make a comprehensible picture out of these? And one of the features of all this work is that we are going to be overwhelmed with data. We're going to have a huge amount of information that we're going to have to try and interpret and which no individual one of us is going to be able to cope with. So already, most of this information is being analyzed in the form of computer programs by various complex algorithms. But I leave you with this fantasy, which is that ultimately what we may have to build within computers is models of the living cells, including all the information that we know of all those things I've mentioned, of which bits are expressed in which tissues, how they interact with each other, how they influence each other. And those computer models may ultimately be what an awful lot of experimentation on human beings is done on, particularly in the form of modeling drugs in those computers, finding out which 99% of those drugs seem to do no good at all or are too toxic, and then pull out that 1% that seem to do some good in your computer model and test that out in your laboratory. But in order to do all this work, for the full exploitation to the maximum benefit of humanity, the human genome sequence has to be in the public domain, and it has to be immediately and it has to be freely available. Thanks very much.